good horse, I called you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 614 of Unwelcome Guests, Granting Autonomy to the Logic of Money, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton. If that title sounded slightly familiar, then it's probably because you were paying attention at the end of last week's show. That was the conclusion of our reading from David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and it's going to form the focus of this show, looking particularly at the history of the banking cartels and the Federal Reserve in the US, the nexus between big business, government, and banking. First, let's remind ourselves, what was that quote from David Graeber with which we ended last week's show?
Under the newly emerging capitalist order, the logic of money was granted autonomy. Political and military power were then gradually reorganized around it.
Now, this is a pithy phrase which I think rewards some deeper reflection. The logic of money was granted autonomy. So money has a certain logic, and it was somehow granted autonomy. What does that mean? Perhaps that people were allowed to use the logic of money, and where it came into conflict with other logics, other laws, maybe other social expectations, such as how you would treat people, then people were allowed to apply the logic of money. As we've looked at many times on the show, what is the logic of money? Pretty much the logic of psychopathy. The logic of, I don't care what happens to anybody else, I want the most for me. That is, of course, explicitly stated as one of the aspects of Homo economicus, a model which is as unflattering as it is unrealistic. That is, unrealistic as far as 99% of humanity goes. There is approximately 1% for whom that comes closer to the mark, those who are psychopaths. So how come, if that is basic to the economics profession, that so many economists manage to go along with it? Is it because they are spineless individuals who've been beaten down by the man and they have to feed their family somehow? Well, that of course describes one or two of them, but I'd like to think not. Is it because they are themselves psychopathic or sociopathic? Well, there is evidence that economists are more selfish than general people, as we've heard on the show. But I don't think that's it. Does it have anything to do with professional training? I think this is a lot closer to the mark. Recalling Jeff Schmitt's fantastic book, Disciplined Minds, about the rigors of professional training, I think it is quite simply, most people learn this stuff when they're quite young and impressionable. If the lecturer and the professor says, this is how it is, well, that decides it. This is, of course, another vital aspect of capitalism, that it has a man. He's the man with the money. He's the man you've got to obey. He doesn't give you polite requests and turn a blind eye if you don't bother to follow them. As a general rule, the man is the one who gives you orders. And what gives him the right to give you that orders? Ah, we see he's got the money. So this is a way of looking at capitalism, this emerging order, as, if you like, a kind of solidification of feudalism. Why did you obey the lord of the manor? What has he got that you haven't got? Well, he's the lord of the manor. Everybody knows who his father was. He's the man. But he doesn't have any concrete, doesn't have any objective proof of that. Your man, the one you got to work for, he's the one who holds the money. the introduction of money, in certain senses, it was a liberating force, because when social class is tied to money, there is the possibility that you could get hold of money. If social class is linked to bloodlines, and you are not born into the right family, well, then there is nothing that you can do about it. So, to the serf whose destiny was already predetermined, switching over to a society which ran according to money may have seemed like quite an attractive option. I think it's hard for us, who're so used to money, to begin to grasp just what a revolution in thought it actually was to see the world in monetary terms. How many aspects of culture, religion, how many different social mores were developed and modified to allow the influence of money to be as pervasive as it indeed became. So for some insight on this point, let's turn to that great cultural dissident of the 20th century, Ivan Illich, on the gradual formation of Homo economicus.
Aristotle tells the story. Karl Polanyi has beautifully analyzed it, that he was shocked by the idea that in recent times citizens of Athens behaved like kapilikoi, kapiliki, which means sausage vendors, fried sausage vendors on the forum. They let the prices go up when there's much demand and no more fried sausage available, and they let them drop if they want to sell off the last already slightly burnt rests of sausages. He was deeply worried by the fact that decent, virtuous Athenians behaved that way. Polanyi made me understand that there is nothing natural about the law of demand and supply. I would see what other people call culture, I would understand as a unique, typical arrangement to a time and place and group by which marketing relationships, exchange relationships related to things which when scarce go up and when more abundant go down in their price, are kept limited to certain specific places. You may engage in these activities on Saturday when the market is open from 6 in the morning until 12 o'clock, or down at the brothel, or over there at the bar. But otherwise, we don't want any of that. For a couple of millennia since Aristotle, most European cultures remained market resistant. Markets were carefully regulated and kept in place. The story of Homo economicus, the story of commodity production, not simple commodity production, but as Marx would say, industrial commodity production, capitalist commodity production, is a story of the last 250 years. It brought with it a total transformation of perception of space, for instance. The space of one kingdom is different from the space of another kingdom. The measures, the weights, are different here and there. When a good passes from one kingdom to the next, it actually changes in nature. The idea of circulation is absent. The idea that something can return to its source without changing its quality is an idea which becomes thinkable only together with vast commodity circulation around 1680. So I'm speaking about a long history during which a certain number of our current certitudes slowly, slowly take shape.
Now, Illich is talking about the European markets there, and as David Graeber explains, the situation was quite different for the Muslim. where the charging of interest was strictly and effectively prohibited. Let's hear some more from that David Graeber quote.
Under the newly emerging capitalist order, the logic of money was granted autonomy. Political and military power were then gradually reorganized around it. True, this was a financial logic that could never have existed without states and armies behind it in the first place. As we have seen in the case of medieval Islam, under genuine free market conditions, in which the state is not involved in regulating the market in any significant way, even in enforcing commercial contracts, purely competitive markets will not develop.
This, I think, is one of the clearest and perhaps one of the most important points in the Graeber book, that the idea about free markets being independent of government, just leave it up to them, invisible hand, is a complete fiction. Markets have never worked like that. Graeber's marshalled a mound of evidence to suggest that markets, as we know them, are closely tied to violence and the need to pay soldiers to support the state. If you had a market that was really free of government interference, people would be free to break their contract, default on loans, and get away with it. So then you're into, then the state has to regulate that. Well, then, now you haven't got a market that's free anymore. Now, if you've been to any Occupy movements in recent days, you've probably seen that this is not a trivial point. Actually, there seems to be no limit to how much money is spent by the state to restore order, the order of these days, the capitalist world, because the laws increasingly are written by corporations for corporations, whereas the funds granted to individuals by the same corporate machine are ever smaller, ever more common reserves of wealth, ever more shared resources are privatized and made the preserve of an elite few. Now, who is it who decides who is wealthy and who is not wealthy? Who is it whose words have to be obeyed? The man, as defined by money. And this brings us to the central point of the banking system. Now, as I've said before on the show, these days, when I tell people that the financial system needs revision, well, actually replacement, it doesn't raise eyebrows in quite the same way that it used to. That's progress, but I've never heard many interesting ideas on the commercially controlled media about how things should be reformed. They're talking about eliminating bankers' bonuses, capital controls, interest rates. They're working inside the frame of economics. Money seems to me to be working as a divide-and-conquer scheme, making people compete with other people, sometimes consciously and sometimes not, but handing all the power to whoever it is who owns these magic beans called money. We've heard in episode 505 about the equation of money and virtue. Those people who have money are, by dint of the fact that they have money, more virtuous, more intelligent, more hard-working. So if you don't have money, you're lazy, stupid, you certainly should never be the man who other people have to listen to. That, I think, is a fake equation, as is the concept of money itself, the concept of reducing the richness of the real world to a single dimension of what is important. Never mind having a small group of psychopaths and sociopaths in charge of that. It seems to me to be beyond ridiculous. I would only call it suicidal. So if you're following me on this, I would encourage you to try and help those around you to get beyond the false solutions offered by the commercial media, to look at who it is who's behind the curtain. What actually goes on in the Bank of International Settlements? Where do central banks, their unelected, unaccountable power, fit into this? most of the very rich people are very rich, not because of their own brilliance or hard work, but because of their lack of scruples as far as accumulation of money, or because of their dad's lack of scruples. And now we're going to have a refresher course on the criminality of the rich business classes of the late 19th and early 20th century in the US. I use the word criminality in its broader meaning because many of these guys were in charge of the government, so unsurprisingly, they are, in the strict legal definition of the word, not criminals, do, however, seem to have demonstrated remarkably few scruples as far as starting wars, plunging millions into depression, or various other side effects of their not-so-savoury activities, which were, of course, financially well rewarded. So, we're living in a world shaped by these people. A world, several countries, such as the US, are ruled by their direct blood descendants, or if not that, their ideological descendants. This is a radio adaptation of a recommended video. If you've got the internet available, I would go straight to the Unwelcome Guest website and watch it now. It's unwelcomeguest.net/614. If you're listening on the radio, I've adapted one or two of the key points by giving you an explanation of some text. Thank you to A Hijab, the YouTube user who made this video, and whose account doesn't seem to feature the video, so there may be some censorship involved. Now, just this morning I heard that spacehijackers.co.uk had their Twitter account suspended because they were using the Olympic rings. I think they were reed painted in the anarchist colours, but those rings are apparently trademarked, so it took a simple email to Twitter to say, could you shut these guys down? They're breaking our copyright. Another illustration of the power of big money. And did it matter whether they had 100, 1,000 or 1,000,000 followers? Well, no. That's another aspect of the logic of money. What people actually want, how people feel, is irrelevant. As the Germans would say, Ordnung muss sein. Not quite an accident that I'm quoting Amtssprache there. The, oh, I have to do that, my hands are tied, a lack of personal autonomy seems to me to be essential to the business at hand. If we're giving autonomy to the logic of money, we can't also give autonomy to people. I'm not quite sure when this video was made. As I say, it's recommended.
It's fairly simple. 9/11 became the excuse to invade Afghanistan. Then the Bush administration convinced us that who we really needed to invade was Iraq. These wars cost lots of money. Where'd we get the money? Mostly by borrowing it, in other words, by selling U.S. Treasury notes and bonds, or by simply creating new money. This drives the value of the dollar down. There is a common misconception about inflation. Most anyone will tell you it is the rising of prices. Rising prices are in fact the result of inflation, inflation being simply an increase in the money supply. The more dollars you print, the less they are worth. During Bush's two terms, the Federal Reserve increased the money supply in the U.S. by a whopping 50%, and under Obama, they've doubled it again. In the decade leading up to the economic crisis, the Federal Reserve and outfits like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac encouraged easy lending policies. The Fed dropped interest rates down to 1%, while the government practically forced banks to make dodgy home loans. This drove home prices up. Lenders bundled these loans and sold them to investors who hedged against potential losses using derivatives, a sort of insurance. This derivatives market grew, by most estimates, into the hundreds of trillions. All the while, American manufacturing jobs had been moving to China, leaving the U.S. with a consumer-based economy based more and more on borrowing and inflation than actual production. With war costs added in, this is a giant house of cards. All that had to happen was for housing prices to slip. Who got us into this mess? Well, the people that run the government, of course. No, not those people. These people.
Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz.
L. Frank Baum's books about the Land of Oz were published between the years 1900 and 1920. It is widely accepted that his children's books were a veiled commentary on the politics of the day, and that the man behind the curtain was an allegory for the robber barons who created the Federal Reserve.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The Great Man Oz has spoken.
Who are you?
Who indeed? The theft of American economic sovereignty by the Federal Reserve, which is not a government agency but rather a cartel set up by private bankers, can really only be understood by going back to the time of the American Revolution. It is widely taught in schools that the causes which drove Americans to split from Britain were taxes on tea, forced quartering of troops, and similar abuses. This is misleading. Before America declared its independence, Parliament had banned the issuance of bills of credit in the colonies with the Currency Act of 1764. This made colonial scrip illegal. In other words, England told America, "You can't print your own money." Benjamin Franklin believed that this was among the primary causes of the American Revolution, something which he tried to explain to England's Parliament. Founders like Jefferson, Franklin, and Madison were strongly opposed to the establishment of a central bank, knowing that it would open the door to foreign and private interests seizing control over America's currency. Jefferson wrote, "I sincerely believe that banking institutions are more dangerous than standing armies, and that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity is but swindling futurity on a large scale." This is Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was the delegate from New York whose moneyed elite he represented. Hamilton supported friendly relations with England and fought to establish a central bank. Many of the founders opposed him on this, as did southern states like Virginia and Maryland. Hamilton's proposal involved the assumption of states' debts by the federal government, which would be offset by new taxes. Virginia and Maryland had already paid off much of their war debt and didn't want to have to pay twice. There was another hot debate going on at the time, where to put the nation's capital. New York and Philadelphia were popular candidates in the North, but some founders were wary of placing the capital in either of these financial centers, where corruption between bankers and politicians could take root. Finally, a compromise was reached. States' debts would be centralized under a federal bank, and in return, the capital would be established on the Potomac River. Hamilton showed his true colors when he was discovered by then-President Adams planning a coup d'etat against the fledgling U.S. government. Despite this little-known fact, Hamilton's face graces the U.S. $10 bill to this day. In the end, Hamilton was shot dead by Jefferson's vice president, Aaron Burr, in a duel over a private dispute. But his supporters, the moneylenders of New England and Great Britain, got their bank. The charter for the First National Bank of the United States was due to run out in 1812. Congress refused to renew the charter. Almost immediately, war between America and Britain broke out. Many causes are given for the War of 1812, but anger over the elimination of the First National Bank, which British bankers held a major stake in, is never mentioned. On the other side of the Atlantic, German banker Mayer Amschel Rothschild and his sons were quickly becoming a banking powerhouse across Europe and England. His eldest son Amschel in Frankfurt, Salomon in Vienna, Nathan in London, Karl in Naples, and James in Paris. Frederick Morton writes, "The history of the House of Rothschild has been to an amazing degree the backstage history of Western Europe, because of their success in making loans not to individuals, but to nations." Napoleon was terrorizing Europe at the time, and Nathan and James, by far the most successful of the Rothschild sons, reaped huge profits by financing both sides of the war. They maintained a sophisticated intelligence network to stay ahead of the news, and when Napoleon finally lost to Wellington, Nathan had spies posted behind the lines at Waterloo, as well as a courier ready to race back to England when the outcome became known. When Nathan heard of Napoleon's defeat, he began selling government bonds, or consols as they were known, hand over fist. Seeing this, the other traders were duped into thinking that Wellington had lost, and a panic ensued. After stocks and bonds had nosedived to a fraction of their price, Baron Rothschild began buying them up again. When the official news of Wellington's victory reached London, prices shot back up. It is said the Baron multiplied his already substantial fortune 20 times over that day. Some, such as Richard Lewinson in his 1937 book, The Profits of War, have claimed that Baron Rothschild gained control of the Bank of England at this time. It is impossible to know for sure how much Nathan made, or what the family is worth, or even what companies they control to any degree of certainty, for the Rothschilds have always kept such information secret. But there is no doubt that they are, and have been for the last two centuries, by far the wealthiest family in the world. The War of 1812 had left America's financial house in shambles, so much so that then-President Madison was persuaded to allow a second central bank to be established. It might be a good idea to look at what was going on behind the scenes at this point. The two richest men in America at the time were Stephen Girard and John Jacob Astor. The Astor family is best known for its real estate, but John Jacob made his fortune first in fur trading and opium. Girard looks like he could use a hat. In current U.S. dollars, these men would have been twice as wealthy as Bill Gates. Girard and Astor both held large shares in Hamilton's First National Bank of the U.S., and after it was shut down, the two men used their influence to promote Alexander Dallas to the post of Treasury Secretary. Dallas used his position to push through a new central bank, which Girard and Astor would be major stockholders in as well. The Second National Bank of the U.S. would not last any longer than the first, however, for in the election of 1828, war hero Andrew Jackson ran on an anti-bank platform and won. As president, addressing a delegation of bankers, he famously said, "You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out, and by the grace of the eternal God, I will rout you out." When Congress approved a bill to recharter the bank in 1832, Jackson vetoed it. Why all the fuss? Why were men like Jackson and Jefferson so opposed to a central bank? Because the ability to control the currency of a nation is the ability to control the nation itself. In the words of James Garfield, "Whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce." It is easy to see the danger inherent in this power falling into private hands when one realizes that with it comes the ability to create booms and busts at will. The present crisis was intended. Insider Richard C. Cook goes so far as to say, "They did it on purpose. The housing bubble and its crash were engineered from the highest levels of the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, and the financial industry." As for the crash of 1929, Ben Bernanke himself spilled the beans at a banquet in 2002. It is doubtful that the private owners of the Fed were ever sorry, however. These booms and busts over the years have all been precipitated for a reason: to redistribute wealth. During booms, wealth gravitates upward due to inflation.
Even before a currency collapses, the damage done by a fiat system is significant. Our monetary system insidiously transfers wealth from the poor and the middle class to the privileged rich. Those who benefit the most are the ones who get to use the newly created credit first.
And following crashes, the most powerful companies snatch up assets and competitors for nickels on the dollar.
Lehman Brothers has filed for bankruptcy.
Wells Fargo will become the largest U.S. bank by branches with an $11.7 billion offer for rival Wachovia. Merrill Lynch, the world's biggest brokerage, has been bought by Bank of America.
Washington Mutual has gone under. The FDIC then turned around and sold WaMu's thrift banking assets to JPMorgan Chase.
This hat trick has been repeated by the world's top businessmen so many times, it is a wonder that booms and busts are universally perceived as unintended. But the truth of the matter is, nearly every economic crisis in American history has been engineered, and there have been many. Two factors contributed to the Rothschild banking family's success. One was their ability to take advantage of financial panics. Maybe more significant was their talent for creating alliances. John Jacob Astor employed an agent, Jacob B. Taylor, to make his real estate deals in order to conceal his identity. Nathan Rothschild and his son Lionel used the same tact. In fact, their American agent during this period was Taylor's own son, Moses. After Jackson shut down the Second National Bank, the National City Bank of New York grew to prominence. Moses Taylor, with Rothschild backing and by buying up shares during the panics of 1837 and 1857, took it over. Reorganized from the ashes of Hamilton's First National Bank in 1812, National City's list of presidents, directors, and stockholders over the years is a veritable who's who of American finance. It was the first and primary investor bank in the Federal Reserve and remains one of America's biggest banks to this day, albeit under a slightly different name. A 1976 congressional report identified three Rothschild subsidiaries in the U.S., the National City Bank of Cleveland, the First City Bank of Houston, and the First National Bank of Seattle. Allegedly, the word city in the names of these banks is a reference to the city. The city is the financial district located in the center of London. Sometimes called the Square Mile, it is actually a sovereign state, much like the Vatican, and maintains its own police force. The city has been the center of world banking since the days of the Western world's first multinational bankers, the Knights Templar. 800 years ago, the Templar Knights built the Crown Temple Church there and made it their home, and England's financial and legal institutions grew up around it. You can find the Templar Knights' familiar Red Cross on the city's coat of arms. For that matter, the Cross of St. George, as it is known, is also a part of the British flag. The city is home to the Bank of England, the Royal Exchange, the London Stock Exchange, the Royal Courts of Justice, and many other financial and legal institutions. National City Bank of New York was originally just called Citibank, as was its sister, the City Bank of Cleveland. They both became national banks in 1865 when they received charters to print U.S. national currency. This was the same year that Lincoln, who had been issuing his own currency, the greenback, was assassinated. What was the difference between the greenbacks that Lincoln printed during the Civil War and the national currency banks like Citibank printed in their place? Banks had been printing a muddled variety of currencies as long as there had been banks in the U.S. Paper currency was ostensibly backed by some amount of gold or silver and loaned out at interest. After the Civil War, many large banks were allowed to issue a national currency for the first time. This was a big step toward the elite's goal of recreating a national central bank. Lincoln's greenbacks, on the other hand, were issued by the Treasury and were interest-free. The greenback threatened to cut the banks out of the whole currency racket. They killed him for it. Only one other president in U.S. history has tried to issue interest-free Treasury notes. They killed him, too.
And there's video of President Kennedy being assassinated.
America in the mid-19th century was marked by rapid Western expansion, and that meant railroads. In the decade between 1860 and 1870, over 20,000 miles of track were laid, linking east to west and providing a way to move grain and cattle from the middle of the continent to the growing cities. All of this development required capital. Investors were more than willing to make loans, not just to turn a profit, but to get their foot in the door of the exploding American economy. The Rothschilds were no exception. In fact, they were pioneers in the financing of railroads on the other side of the Atlantic. Another Rothschild associate got in on the ground floor of one of America's first railroads, the B&O, a man by the name of George Peabody. Peabody was taken under the Rothschild wing in the 1830s and opened an office in London. He quickly became the go-to guy for British investors interested in American ventures and dealt in U.S. and state bonds, canals, transatlantic cable and railroads, and even shipped steel to the U.S. for laying track. But Peabody and Company's involvement in the American Railroad would really shift into high gear after Peabody retired and turned his company over to his partner, Junius Morgan, in 1864. The company was renamed J.S. Morgan & Company, and Junius' son, John Pierpont Morgan, backed by unlimited Rothschild funds, would become the most powerful banker in the United States. Not only is the Morgan name familiar to every American, so is his likeness.
And it shows his likeness. He is Mr. Money on the Monopoly board.
Alexander Brown was a linen merchant who emigrated to Baltimore from Ireland in 1800, becoming very successful. He was a major stockholder in the Second National Bank of the United States, along with Girard and Astor, and his sons would go on to found one of the largest merchant banks in America. Brown Brothers had a London branch as well, Brown Shipley and Company. The Browns have always had close ties to the Bank of England. In fact, it is an unwritten rule that the bank's board of governors must always include a Brown Shipley director. One of them, Lord Montague Norman, served as governor of the Bank of England longer than anyone in history. If you guessed that the Browns enjoyed close ties to the Rothschilds, you would be correct. In fact, it was through George Peabody's connections with the Brown family that he was first welcomed into the Rothschild circle. Undoubtedly, the Rothschilds' closest allies were two German banking families, the Schiffs and the Warburgs. The Warburg family name is legendary in banking. M.M. Warburg & Company, based in Hamburg, is the oldest bank in the world and remains in private hands. The Schiff family shared a house with the Rothschilds in Frankfurt, the very house that Nathan and his brothers grew up in. Jacob Schiff first came to America after the Civil War and in 1875 went to work for Kuhn Loeb & Company. He promptly married co-founder Solomon Loeb's daughter, Therese, and took over the bank. Paul Warburg, who was regarded as the architect of the Federal Reserve System, followed in Jacob Schiff's footsteps, first marrying Solomon Loeb's other daughter, Nina, and then joining Kuhn and Loeb when he too came to America in 1902. Warburg was chairman of his own bank, the Bank of Manhattan, and sat on the boards of many important companies, often together with Schiff. Before Warburg came to join him in New York, though, Jacob Schiff spotted two promising entrepreneurs and lent them his support. One would become the undisputed king of oil, the other, America's preeminent railroad baron, John D. Rockefeller and Edward H. Harriman. Rockefeller was pious, hardworking, and ruthless. He and his brother William formed Standard Oil together, and by buying out or forcing out competitors, the company at one time controlled 90% of the refining business in the U.S. Harriman was no slouch either. He would eventually control the Union Pacific, the Southern Pacific, the Illinois Central, and a few other lines, as well as the Wells Fargo Express. He also sat on the board of National City Bank of New York, along with Schiff. Jacob Schiff arranged the financing for both the Harriman and Rockefeller empires, either through Kuhn and Loeb or National City Bank of Cleveland. The Rockefellers dabbled in banking too. William Rockefeller and his son Percy were both directors at National City Bank of New York, and William's grandson James would one day be chairman. The bank best known as a Rockefeller bank, though, was Chase, which was built up by John D. Rockefeller's son. Eventually, Chase would merge with Paul Warburg's bank to become Chase Manhattan, after which J.D. Rockefeller's grandson David would become chairman there. Oddly, these two New York banks were considered rivals, despite the fact that they were run largely by the same family. If the Rockefellers had a rival, it would have been Morgan. J.P. Morgan pioneered the merger. He financed Thomas Edison's company and merged it with another electric company to form General Electric. He bought Andrew Carnegie's Steel Corporation and combined it with others to create U.S. Steel. In the early 1900s, Morgan and his companies controlled $1 billion in assets, an incredible sum at the time. Which is why there was universal surprise when it was discovered upon Morgan's death that the worth of his estate was only around $70 million. A lot of money in those days, but nothing like what he was believed to be worth. The truth is, he was playing with someone else's money half the time. Morgan, like the rest of these players, was one brick in a financial pyramid, the top tier of which was occupied by the Rothschilds. With the addition of a few other bit players, this pyramid is a pretty good representation of the cartel that would form the Federal Reserve in 1913. But first, there would be a war. The similarities between the Spanish-American War and the war in Iraq are uncanny. Both happened around the turn of the century. Both were preceded by a well-coordinated propaganda campaign. Both were won quickly, but were followed by a long and painful occupation period. The U.S. was bogged down for years in the Philippines fighting insurgents. The death tolls of both invading U.S. troops and local civilians are eerily similar. Finally, both wars were based on a lie and initially supported by an American public which had been duped. While the robber barons were consolidating their control over American industry, several politicians, a Navy admiral, a newspaper man, and a lawyer were beating the war drum, pushing the U.S. toward war with Spain, which still held possessions in the Caribbean. You might think of them as the neoconservatives of 100 years ago. A couple of these men are worth taking a quick look at. The leader of this group was Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt helped drum up support for war with fiery speeches, while he and Elihu Root led a campaign to modernize the U.S. Navy. Root was Secretary of War at the time under McKinley, and Roosevelt became Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1897. If you were wondering if these men were connected in any way to the bankers and tycoons we've been talking about, Elihu Root was their lawyer. He personally handled the legal affairs of J.P. Morgan, E.H. Harriman, and other powerful men, constantly running back and forth between Washington and New York. The Spanish were no saints, and an independence movement had sprung up in Cuba. The rebellion became more belligerent with U.S. backing, and Spain responded by throwing Cubans into relocation camps. William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper mogul, ran stories vilifying the Spanish and their abuses. Reportedly, an artist he had sent to Cuba to record the alleged crisis wired back, saying there was nothing to draw. Hearst famously replied, "You provide the pictures, I'll provide the war." In 1898, the USS Maine was sent to Cuba to keep an eye on things. 3 weeks later, an explosion sent the Maine, along with 260 American sailors, to the bottom of Havana Harbor. Spain was blamed and the U.S. declared war. Spain's wooden ships were no match for the newly modernized U.S. Navy, and the war was over within months. the U.S. took possession of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. Cuba was given limited independence, but the U.S. kept Guantanamo Bay for itself. As it turned out, Spain had nothing to do with the sinking of the Maine. It's unclear if the explosion was a simple onboard accident or if the ship was intentionally sunk to get the war started. Either way, with its victory over the Spanish, America entered the new century as a world power. President McKinley was re-elected in 1900 with Teddy Roosevelt as his running mate. McKinley, who had resisted going to war, was barely into his second term 6 months when he was assassinated. Teddy Roosevelt assumed the presidency.
Trust busting, the Panic of 1907, and the passage of the Federal Reserve Act.
Now the bankers, with their sights set on a central bank, had almost all of their ducks in a row. With allies in control of both American government and industry, only one thing stood in their way: the attitudes of the American public. Americans had become fearful of the great power that was being amassed in the hands of a few wealthy men. This was compounded when Harriman and Morgan, who had been fighting over control of the Northern Pacific Railroad, decided to set aside their differences and form a large trust. The Northern Securities Company, which Rockefeller got a piece of as well, combined several Northern railroads under one umbrella. Teddy Roosevelt decided to attack both Northern Securities and Standard Oil for antitrust violations. These lawsuits culminated in the breakup of both monopolies. In 1907, while all of this trust busting was going on, there was a financial panic, started by a run on the Knickerbocker Trust Company. J.P. Morgan intervened and saved the nation from a crash. What few realized was that before Morgan stepped in to stop the panic, he helped create it. Doctor of Law and author Ellen Brown described the panic and its significance aptly. The panic of 1907 was triggered by rumors that two major banks were about to become insolvent. Later evidence pointed to the House of Morgan as the source of the rumors. The public, believing the rumors, proceeded to make them come true by staging a run on the banks. Morgan then nobly stepped in to avert the panic by importing $100 million in gold from his European sources. The public thus became convinced that the country needed a central banking system to stop future panics, overcoming strong congressional opposition to any bill allowing the nation's money to be issued by a private central bank controlled by Wall Street. This was all well understood at the time by some. In 1913, House Representative Charles Lindbergh Sr. stated into the Congressional Record, "The Money Trust caused the 1907 panic and thereby forced Congress to create a National Monetary Commission." The National Monetary Commission was formed to study ways to stabilize the U.S. financial system. The commission finally made its recommendation after traveling around Europe for 2 years on the country's tab. What the country really needed was, can you guess? A central bank. Which is no surprise. The commission's leader, the powerful senator from Rhode Island, Nelson Aldrich, held shares in New York's biggest banks. His daughter, Abby, married John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Yes, Nelson Aldrich was David Rockefeller's grandfather. What about Teddy Roosevelt? Where did his loyalties lie? Roosevelt, like his fifth cousin Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was from a wealthy Dutch family who were connected by marriage to the Astors. The Roosevelt, Delano, and Astor families literally intertwine like threads in a rug. Like the Astors, the Roosevelts held large tracts of land in Manhattan, which Teddy's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Klaus Van Roosevelt, purchased back when New York was still a Dutch colony. Roosevelt was known to be a Morgan man, was friends with Edward Harriman, and had accepted campaign contributions from Rockefeller. Both Roosevelt and his longtime friend and Secretary of State, Elihu Root, helped further the agenda of the Money Trust in many ways. So if Roosevelt was on the side of the bankers, why did he attack Standard Oil and Northern Securities? There is only one reasonable explanation. It was a ploy to allay public fears. It convinced the nation that the politicians were on the side of the people and that the power of the monopolists had been checked. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Rockefeller was hardly inconvenienced by the attack. The 34 small pieces the Supreme Court broke Standard Oil up into were still Rockefeller-controlled companies. The family's stock values doubled with the restructuring, and four of those new companies would later become Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, and Amoco. I don't think Jefferson, who rallied against central banking at America's inception, or Lincoln, who tried to free the American people from debt-based privately issued currency, or Washington, who warned against unnecessary wars and foreign entanglements, are much too happy to have Teddy Roosevelt sitting up there with them on Mount Rushmore. Roosevelt's trust-busting accomplished one other thing. It kept the spotlight off of what the bankers were really up to. In 1910, 7 men got on a train headed for Jekyll Island, Georgia, ostensibly to do some duck hunting. Nelson Aldridge was among them, as was Paul Warburg, and representatives of the Rockefeller and Morgan banking interests. Also there was Abram Andrews, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. The men took precautions to ensure complete secrecy and referred to each other only by their first names. Over the next 10 days, they hammered out the details of what would become the Federal Reserve System. The proposal was originally introduced in Congress as the Aldrich Plan, but was shot down. Paul Warburg rewrote it under the name the Federal Reserve Act, which Senator Aldrich publicly opposed to try and fool the other congressmen. The two bills were essentially the same. Lest we forget who was ultimately behind this, an agent of Brown Brothers, Colonel Elisha Garrison, wrote in his 1931 book, Roosevelt, Wilson, and the Federal Reserve Law. Paul Warburg is the man who got the Federal Reserve Act together after the Aldrich Plan aroused such nationwide resentment and opposition. The mastermind of both plans was Baron Alfred Rothschild of London. The Act passed the House and Senate in late December of 1913, and the differences were hammered out while most congressmen were out of town for the holidays. It is debatable whether Woodrow Wilson, who signed the bill the next day, fully understood the nature of what he was a party to, or if he was simply a puppet. Certainly, Colonel Edward M. House deserves much of the credit for Wilson's cooperation. House's father had made his fortune running blockades during the Civil War and trading with British investors, including the Rothschilds. Colonel House was solidly in the inner circle of the Money Trust and was Wilson's most trusted advisor, maintaining a residence in the White House. Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law on December 23, 1913. Jacob Schiff sent a letter to Colonel House, thanking him.
My dear Colonel House, I want to say a word to you for the silent but no doubt effective work you have done in the interest of currency legislation, and to congratulate you that the measure has finally been enacted into law. I am, with good wishes, faithfully yours, Jacob Schiff.
Finally, the bankers had control over America's money, but that's not all. That same year the Federal Reserve Act was passed, Congress also passed income tax legislation for the first time, which would enable the government to tax people's labor in order to pay the interest on the money it would now have to borrow from the Fed. And it wouldn't be long before America would start borrowing like never before to pay for its involvement in a war. Arguably, not a single war in modern history has been fought for the reasons advertised. Most people think the First World War started over the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. This did provide an excuse, but the truth of the matter is, cars, planes, and diesel engines for locomotives and ships had been invented, all which ran on oil. The demand for this resource was about to explode, and the Rockefellers, with their Standard Oil monopoly in the U.S., and the Rothschilds, with their control of the Royal Dutch Shell Company across the Atlantic, had the market practically cornered. Then in 1908, oil was discovered in Persia. Much of the Middle East at that time was under the control of the Ottoman Empire, who, in partnership with Germany, were in the process of building a railroad to Baghdad. This had to be stopped. It was time to kick the Turks out of the Middle East.
And this bold stating of the geopolitical facts of life strikes the modern reader with the force of revelation, for there is in our own time an absolute taboo among the corporate news media and the political class against mentioning anything to do with the strategic and economic reasons for war. How curious, for example, that the First World War is never taught in our schools as an invasion of Iraq. Not all of you are coming with me on that one. That's okay, don't worry. I will say many things in the course of tonight's show that you will not agree with. But I feel that if we retrench back to a position of consensus, we can build outwards from there. So going back to where I believe some consensus to exist between us, possibly. I am sure many of you, like me, have never been entirely satisfied with the standard explanation we were given at secondary school for the causes and origins of the First World War. The assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. I mean, no one is that popular. A somewhat more efficient cause might be the Berlin-Baghdad Railway, commenced construction in the years leading up to the First World War. The Royal Navy had just switched from coal to oil. German Navy follows suit, but they don't have no oil-producing colonies. Thus begins Drang nach Osten, the drive to the east, spine of which policy is the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. Now, there's already track laid from Berlin to Constantinople. Of course, it's called the Orient Express. The Germans just have to build the last 900 clicks. It's going to take them clear into Baghdad, but there is huge opposition to this project among the major European powers. And the British, we're opposed to this for two main reasons. Firstly, we recognize that we cannot compete with the Germans in engineering terms alone, because we know that passengers will simply not accept the Sarajevo to Basra replacement bus service. Secondly, we know once this is built, ain't nothing to stop a Munich businessman getting out of the Baghdad terminus with a Deutsche Bank checkbook, smashing our cartel. So a phony war begins. The first British regiment to be deployed in the First World War, the Dorset Regiment, goes to Basra, 1914, where it is joined by 51 other British divisions.
Ah, what a difference 100 years makes. Not. Getting the European powers embroiled in a war was one thing. Getting the U.S. involved was something else. Americans wanted nothing to do with the war. That is, until the Lusitania, with 196 American passengers on board, was sunk off the coast of Ireland by a German U-boat. Evidence which indicates that the passengers of the Lusitania were sacrificed to spark U.S. entry into World War I, while regarded as the stuff of conspiracy theories, is well documented. The British use of merchant ships to ram German submarines had rendered civilian vessels fair game in the eyes of the Germans. This was well known, yet the Lusitania sailed into hostile waters without a military escort. One of the ship's boilers had been shut down, reducing its speed and making it an easy target. Despite claims to the contrary, the Lusitania was carrying munitions, which were listed on the ship's manifest. Germany took out an ad in a few dozen American newspapers warning that ships flying the flag of Britain or her allies would be attacked, ads which the U.S. government tried to stop papers from printing. Wilson's advisor, Colonel House, spoke with the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, about the Lusitania the morning of the day it was attacked, recording in his journal that its sinking would carry us into the war. He was right. It did. War's effectiveness at pushing nations into debt can easily be seen on this tally provided by the Treasury Department. The country's debt jumped 900% between the years preceding and following the war. It ballooned more than sixfold again as the country entered World War II. But apart from the purely economic reasons for getting America involved in these wars, on another level there was something else going on.
At what point in your career did you become connected with the Rees Committee?
1953.
Yeah. And what was that capacity, sir?
That was the capacity of what they call Director of Research for the Rees Committee.
Can you tell us what the Rees Committee was attempting to do?
Yes, I can tell you. It was operating and carrying out instructions embodied in a resolution passed by the House of Representatives, which was to investigate the activities of foundations as to whether or not these activities could justifiably be labeled un-American without, I might say, defining what they meant by un-American. That what we had uncovered was the determination of these large endowed foundations through their trustees to actually get control over the content of American education. Rowan Gaither was at that time president of the Ford Foundation, and Mr. Gaither had sent for me when I found it convenient to be in New York. Mr. Gaither said, "Mr. Dodd, we've asked you to come up here this today because we thought that possibly off the record you would tell us why the Congress is interested in the activities of foundations such as ourselves. Mr. Gaither then went on voluntarily and stated, he said, Mr. Dodd, all of us that have a hand in the making of policies here have had experience either with the OSS during the war or the European Economic Administration after the war. We've had experience operating under directives. We here operate on similar, in response to similar directives, the substance of which is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Well, parenthetically, Mr. Griffin, I nearly fell off the chair. My response to Mr. Gaither then was, well, Mr. Gaither, I can now answer your first question. You forced the Congress of the United States to spend $150,000 to find out what you just told me. I said, of course, legally, you're entitled to make grants for this purpose, but I don't think you're entitled to withhold that information from the people of the country to whom you're indebted for your tax exemption. So why don't you tell the people of the country that's what you told me? And his answer was, we would not think of doing any such thing. So then I said, well, Mr. Gaither, obviously, you forced the Congress to spend this money. Dr. Johnson, who was then president of the Carnegie Endowment, telephoned me and said, did I ever come up to New York? And I said, yes, I did, more or less each weekend. And he said, well, when you're next here, will you drop in and see us? Which I did. And Dr. Johnson said, after, again, amenities, Mr. Dodd, we have your letter. We can answer all those questions, but it'd be a great deal of trouble. And we have a counter suggestion. Is that if you can spare a member of your staff for 2 weeks and send that member up to New York, we will give to that member a room in the library and the minute books of this foundation since its inception. And we think that whatever you want to find out or the Congress wants to find out will be obvious from those minutes. Well, my first reaction was they'd lost their mind. I had a pretty good idea of what those minutes would contain, but I realized that Dr. Johnson had only been in office 2 years and the vice presidents were relatively young men, and counsel seemed to be also a young man, and I guess that probably they'd never read the minutes themselves. And so I said I had somebody, I would accept their offer, and I went back to Washington, and I selected the member of my staff who was on my staff, having been a practicing attorney in Washington, but she was on my staff to see to it that I didn't break any congressional procedures or rules. In addition to which, she was unsympathetic to the purpose of the investigation. She was level-headed and a very reasonably brilliant, capable lady. And her attitude toward the investigation was, what could possibly be wrong with foundations? They do so much good. Well, in the face of that sincere conviction of Catherine's, I went out of my way not to prejudice her in any way. And off she went to New York.